Hello, learners, and welcome to Learn On Podcast, the science show by kids for kids. I'm your host, John C., and I'm here today with a very special guest. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is David Scher, and I'm a recently retired cardiologist and digital health technology consultant. I live in Philadelphia.
Awesome. So you mentioned that you're recently retired. Can you tell us about your story and the journey in your career up until now?
Sure. So I went to college. I went to medical school. I did my training in internal medicine, which is 3 years. I became a chief medical resident, and that was in New York. And then I got interested in cardiology. As a trainee in medicine, you get exposed to different types of medicine, and cardiology was something that really interested me. Actually, from a technology standpoint, I really enjoyed finding out about pacemakers, how they work, and things, heart monitors and things of that nature. And that really was what got me interested in cardiology, and actually ultimately the specialty in cardiology I entered, which was electrophysiology, which is the specialty of cardiac heart rhythm disorders.
That's really interesting. And I'm sure that there has been a lot of development in technology, even over the past just few years with cardiology and medicine in general. So what has your experience been like watching medical technology evolve and reach new heights?
So that's a great question. I'm actually living history of the evolution of what has gone on in cardiology. When I was training, the best we can do for a heart attack was give actually a new medication at that time to decrease the clotting of the blood, which causes a heart attack. And now we have incredible devices like heart stents, which are metal tunnels, which keep arteries open. We've gone from very elementary kinds of pacemakers to very complicated ones, which really last a lot longer, do a lot more things. I saw the advent of the implantable defibrillator. And in 1985, for example, the hospital where I was at, we put in 10 defibrillators, and we were one of the biggest centers in the country. And when I finished my career, I myself was implanting over 300 defibrillators a year. So things of that nature have really taken off. But a lot of technology is really happening in the drug world as well. Developments of new drugs, which keep heart arteries open, and even, you know, going off topic a little, cancer drugs. So yeah, it's been very exciting watching a lot of things happen in medicine.
Absolutely. And I feel like when we are in the moment reading articles about new technologies to release in the next few years, or learning about something that's in the process of getting FDA approved, it might feel like it's really slow, but then just reflecting back on the past few decades, it's crazy to see the magnitude of change that we've been able to make. So I'm really glad that you were able to share your experience with us. And then how did you make the decision to shift from being a cardiologist to advising in digital health?
So that's also an interesting question. I was always fascinated with digital technology. My practice in 1997 actually had an electronic record, which was mobile on a Palm Pilot. You're pretty young, so I don't know if you know what a Palm Pilot was, but it was the first mobile device that was not even a telephone per se. And it was awesome. So it was fun. And we actually, since we had this capability, we actually were able to get our office notes in the hospital, but the problem was the hospital had no PCs. So we actually made the hospital get personal computers so that we can get our office records. It's sort of topsy-turvy to what people think, you know, is the natural progression of things today. But what really sparked my interest was in the year 2000, I was an investigator as a pilot study for a company called Medtronic, which is the biggest medical device company in the world. And they developed the ability to actually monitor implantable defibrillators wirelessly with satellite technology, or cell, and then became cell technology. And that was very exciting. And only a couple of years after that, I did a project which successfully took that data that we derived from the devices and melded it and got it into the electronic record. And that was very exciting also. So all of that got me totally interested in digital health in general, because it raised the importance of what's called remote patient monitoring, which is what this technology does, not only with the implantable heart rhythm devices, but now we have this for diabetes, we have it for respiratory issues and other things. So remote monitoring itself is a digital technology which has really come far, with which I'm very much involved.
Yeah, it's wonderful to hear your experience of kind of firsthand being able to witness the power of digital health and watching the development of these novel technologies. And your mention of remote patient monitoring actually made me curious about something. So we've kind of talked about it a little bit before on the podcast, but how can digital health innovation help to combat problems in health equity and maybe make healthcare more accessible for patients?
You know, when we first had this capability of monitoring defibrillators in countries like France, who have what we call socialized medicine, they actually used to pay their patients to come to the office if they live far away to get their devices checked. And now with the advent of remote monitoring, those patients don't have to do that anymore. So it's not only just a convenience, but actually remote monitoring has shown that you can catch things earlier before they become catastrophic in patients. And the other thing is that remote monitoring of implantable rhythm devices in general monitors not only the patient's rhythm, but the functionality of the device itself. So a few years after this was started to be used, they actually discovered a defect in one of the defibrillator wires solely through the ability to monitor these devices on a population scale. So it resulted in a recall of that component. So now we realize the importance of it, not just as a convenience factor, but also as a patient safety issue.
That's really interesting. I think I've definitely heard about how digital health innovation and remote patient monitoring can help to give patients access that maybe in rural areas and don't have the capability of like driving into a clinic to get checked regularly, and also for disabled and elderly patients who may not have the kind of support system that allows them to do that. But I certainly hadn't considered also being able to monitor the actual quality of the devices themselves. So that was definitely really interesting to learn about. And then to dive a little bit deeper into applications in digital health in the healthcare system, I'm kind of interested in learning more about the different perspectives of it. So maybe we can talk a little bit more about how digital health innovation can help improve patients' experiences. And then on the flip side, how can it help improve doctors' experiences?
So those are great questions. And initially, when remote monitoring came out, patients and referring physicians to me actually were feeling very negative about it, because their first impulse was that this is a technology that's going to come in between myself and my doctor. You know, in other words, they thought that the device was going to take over the function of their physician. And even though it decreased the frequency with which somebody had to come to the office, they didn't see the convenience factor as much as potentially disrupting that relationship. And, you know, I went all around the world, you know, discussing this. And what people need to know is that this actually brings you closer to your physician, because they're monitoring you on a daily basis, whether it's your rhythm or the device or your blood sugar or breathing, you know, status. It actually keeps you in closer touch with your physician, even though you're not physically in touch. So it becomes really a patient advocate type of technology. The other thing is, patients, when they're being monitored and they're actually causing data to go to the physician, get a sense of not just being closer to the physician that way, but in charge of their care, in the sense that they are now the source of information which is being used to monitor and treat them. So to me, you know, it's a patient positive kind of thing. And for physicians, the main pushback from physicians now is that there is so much data coming to them from patients that the only way that this is going to work, and it did work that way initially with implantable devices, but startup companies don't think of this, is the fact that the data that comes to clinicians has to be actionable. In other words, it has to be relevant and something that is going to make a difference in care. Because if it doesn't, then it's really useless data. So for example, it's much better to get a look of blood pressures or blood sugars over an extended period of time. And that time can be a week, it doesn't have to be years, to make a better decision about what to do based on a single blood pressure reading or blood sugar reading, which is really not the best way to treat patients.
Right. Yeah. I'm really glad that you brought up the doctor side of it and how we can kind of maybe refine our systems and improve the way that we collect data, or at least present it in the way that I guess startups do to doctors, to make it more efficient for doctors as well, and to just kind of have that more organized. That was definitely something that I hadn't considered. So I learned something new. And I'm also really glad that you brought up the implications of digital health, or rather the lack of implications maybe, on the doctor-patient relationship. That was something that I was wondering about as well, and maybe something that we can discuss a little bit later in our conversation. So that was a really great answer. And then also to pivot a little bit more towards you. So what is your role in SpeechMed, and what inspired you to take up this work, and what does SpeechMed do?
So SpeechMed is a company that has a software platform which allows patients to get all of their information either in written or audio form in their own language. And the reason why we are better than, say, Google Translate or those kind of technologies that are available today is that studies show that we are 30% better than them. We're almost 100% accurate in medicine. Google Translate is okay for maybe symptoms or just regular language translation conversationally. But in medicine specifically, when you're talking about procedures, medications and stuff, those things can really, if you make a mistake, can really result in serious problems. So I really got involved with SpeechMed. I met their chief executive officer, Susan Perry, at a conference called HIMSS, which is the Health Information Technology conference, which is amazing in and of itself. And the story of SpeechMed, which really opens up healthcare to anybody of any language, even disabled people. So if somebody has problems being sighted, we can have everything translated into Braille. Or if they have a hearing issue, we can make it audio, we can make it Braille. And the other thing to consider is health literacy. And health literacy means the ability to absorb what somebody is telling you in the office and to be able to explain it to someone else. So you have to absorb it, understand it to the point that you can actually explain it to someone else. And when you talk about proficient health literacy or people that really can do this, you're talking only about 12 to 14% of the population. And that includes people with PhDs and you know, it has nothing to do necessarily with education. It has more to do with socioeconomic backgrounds, cultural backgrounds, the language that you spoke before you went to college, to regular school. So in other words, your real native language, these things really come into play with regards to what's called health equity or the ability to have the same outcomes in healthcare as anybody else. So I love that aspect of SpeechMed, and it's really been eye-opening working with them. It's actually a law that hospitals and physicians have to give you this information in your own language, and some do and some don't. And the encounters in the office are either usually done by a live translator or audiovisual equipment. And that's great. But when the patient leaves the office, they always have questions, and that's a natural thing. But if they can't get those questions answered in their native language, it's a problem. So with SpeechMed, they have all of that stuff available on a medical app. And when they get home, they can play it themselves or look at it themselves and share it with a caregiver as well.
That's awesome. Yeah, I really loved learning about the mission of SpeechMed. I think that it's so fantastic that with the power of new technology, we are able to really empower patients to advocate for themselves, to improve their health literacy, and also bridge any possible gaps between the doctor and the patient. And I think it's so interesting how SpeechMed is able to serve many different people, such as people who may have issues with sight, people who may not be fluent in the language that their doctor speaks, may not have health literacy. And then I also remember reading on the SpeechMed website about families who may be speaking like their native language and then the language that their country speaks, and like have a mix of that. So that also helps bridge the gap between the patient and who may be their caregiver. And I also think it's really interesting how this allows the patient to have all of their information accessible so that they can even ask questions for the next appointment and just be up to date on it. And to me, it makes so much sense that we're making progress in this, because considering that many patients, their lives literally rely on the medication they're taking or whatever their treatment plan is, they should be able to understand fully what it is that they're putting in their body, what their doctor is prescribing to them, without having major boundaries of language interfering with that. So thank you so much for sharing that.
Yeah, and the other thing we do is we have patient reminders. So if we have medication reminders in their own language, we have reminders about appointments. We are now developing platforms where patients will get preoperative or pre-procedure instructions. Sometimes when you have a procedure or surgery, you need instructions beforehand to do some preparation for that. And we're specializing in doing that and making sure with a mobile app that patients can actually confirm to their physician that they've done the preparation so that everything runs smoothly throughout the course of the procedure itself.
Right. That's fantastic. And it's always fascinated me how much of the lack of health equity we can combat that may be caused, like, by, for example, disparities in socioeconomic status just by bridging the language gap. Absolutely. So it's fantastic. Yeah. And then I guess to dive a little bit deeper into what was your specific specialty of cardiology, I've been reading so much about like the applications of artificial intelligence and upcoming technologies, not in cardiology, but just in general medicine for the past few years. And it's so interesting to see how much more we've spotlighted kind of these advancements. So maybe can you tell us more about some upcoming technological advancements in cardiology that you might be interested in? I know ones that I've read about are like really niche applications of artificial intelligence or robotic microsurgery, but maybe it would be interesting to just discuss that a little bit more.
Yeah, so things are moving all the time, and artificial intelligence is on everybody's short list of cool things these days. There's a lot that goes into that. We can talk for hours about, you know, what is artificial intelligence compared to what people think it is, et cetera. But yeah, so artificial intelligence is being applied in very cool ways. In other words, when we do an electrocardiogram on someone, we traditionally just look at the rhythm and we look at a certain amount of fundamental kinds of things we can take away from it. Artificial intelligence applied to the regular electrocardiogram is telling us now things about the structure of the heart without even seeing a picture of the heart and function of the heart. So it's incredible what micro measurements and more importantly, comparison of this electrocardiogram to others. So as the pool of people who are being studied, for example, 23andMe, the more people that are in that, the more chance you're going to have of finding somebody that is related to you, you know, that kind of thing. So it's being applied that way. It's being applied to imaging, the same as it's being applied to a lot of imaging. And that's not to say that artificial intelligence is going to replace physicians or people looking at these things. But even today, we have computers that read electrocardiograms, and then physicians overread the computer. So there always needs to be a human component of this. In fact, the artificial intelligence comes from humans programming a computer to learn itself. So you still have the input of humans. In fact, there is talk today about some, you know, about biases that are being introduced into artificial intelligence because of the fact that it is a human, you know, programming it. And so people need to be aware of these things. I would hope that the lessons that we've learned and have seen in other areas will spill over into artificial intelligence, whereby these biases are less inherent in, you know, as the technology is developed. As far as other things go, yeah, we can change valves now in the heart instead of having an open surgery and being in the hospital for a week and then recovering for many months. We're able to do that through a pinhole in the groin now. And so we've really developed, you know, a lot that way. Certainly robotic surgery has taken over a lot of general surgery. And so technology itself is really incredible. What we do better than other countries is really waste money in investing in a ton of these technologies. For example, you have an MRI on every corner in the United States, and that's not the case in most other countries, so that they spend their money a lot better than we do in healthcare, and that's no secret. So with technology comes, you know, certain unintended consequences, and we should be aware of those.
Definitely, yeah. As for the artificial intelligence bias topic, it's something that I've always been kind of interested in since I've dabbled in a little bit of artificial intelligence research myself. I was actually just at a research symposium yesterday for the conclusion of a project that I've been doing this summer. And one student that was presenting there had a project on natural language processing and kind of trying to detect and prevent racial bias in artificial intelligence and its applications in medicine. And I think that's so important to consider because all of these biases are really just coming from the data that we feed it. We may not even realize the negative patterns or the underrepresentation of certain minority groups in data that then gets exacerbated and magnified when you're training such a powerful model and trying to apply it. And I'm also really glad that you brought up kind of the question about whether artificial intelligence can ever replace doctors. That was exactly what I was going to ask next, because I feel like in the age of ChatGPT and artificial intelligence being spotlighted in media now more than ever, there's kind of, I don't know if like hysteria is the right word, but there's certainly a lot of talk and a lot of concern about the ability of artificial intelligence to replace different careers. And of course, it's a unique conversation for every industry, but at least for medicine, I find it really hard to imagine that an entire hospital of healthcare workers can just be replaced by high-level chatbots and different diagnostic models. But can we talk a little bit more about what the future of that looks like and maybe a certain point into the future, how much physicians can really collaborate with artificial intelligence technologies to improve diagnostics and the patient experience overall?
Sure. So artificial intelligence now is being applied mostly towards hospital operational kinds of stuff, billing. You know, the most important thing is that we apply this in a way in which it helps solve a problem, not cause more problems than it's solving. So a lot of the artificial intelligence now is going into what we call back office kind of functions. When it gets into medicine, you're always going to need a person, whether it's a nurse or a physician or somebody transporting somebody, you know, somewhere in a wheelchair. And, you know, we may use artificial intelligence to look up drugs or to help us look at an image. But when you're facing a patient and holding their hand, telling them they have a serious illness, or letting them hug you because they got a lot better after the last time they saw you, you know, that stuff can't be replaced with artificial intelligence. So I really don't see that taking place. And I certainly would say it's a nightmare, you know, if somebody thinks that, but it's not going to happen. And I'm very much looking forward to artificial intelligence helping us. You know, there's a lot of information out there in medicine, and a physician is trained to think a certain way, which is fine, but that itself is inherently biased. And it may be as biased as the person who taught you, you know, either in medical school or training along the line. So the human factor is always there, but the artificial intelligence can help us with facts, it can help us with diagnoses, but it will never change the, hopefully, the relationship, you know, between patients and physicians and clinicians.
Right. I feel like because there's so much more talk about artificial intelligence and it's no longer this really hyper-specific thing that it's only discussed by professionals in computer science and engineering, it's really, really easy to think about the future of artificial intelligence is like the AI itself has the reins and the doctor is kind of following. Whereas I feel like, at least based on the applications that I've seen and what we just talked about, it's much easier and also much more comforting to think about artificial intelligence as someone looking over the doctor's shoulder and kind of confirming what the doctor's suspicions were or just helping to improve that accuracy. And I think also because of the physician shortage and the projected numbers in the future seem kind of scary about how many physicians that might be needed and also physician burnout resulting from the pandemic and many other factors, artificial intelligence can, if anything, help us with all of that. So this was certainly a great discussion. And then now to kind of shift our talk back to the broader horizons of digital health, are there maybe any implications of digital health, positive or negative, that are less recognized in general discussions about this field that you would like to shed a light on for us?
Well, I think that people have, I think the number one thing is to have people not get too overwhelmed with hype. And there's been a lot of hype in digital health since, you know, sort of the beginning or the dawn of this, which is around 2010. And it's still going. And the thing is that people have to realize what is beneficial and what isn't. Okay. So we are first realizing that, you know, that people that are being active have less cardiovascular risk or as far as heart attack or stroke than people that are inactive. When the Fitbit came out, it was touted as a basic cure for, you know, anybody who wants to prevent heart disease. Well, obviously that's not true. And physicians really looked at this as something, you know, from left field, very, very different, didn't know how to deal with it. Patients came to them saying, my Fitbit says this or that. And so what we've learned over time are the limitations of these technologies with regards to the accuracy. Certain technologies have been developed that are accurate, that have been FDA approved, like the Cardia mobile electrocardiogram, and then later the Apple Watch and things of that nature. So as you see artificial intelligence and digital technologies being developed, the most important thing is to ask yourself or to research whether these claims have been proved accurate, whether the technology has been approved by regulatory bodies, how many patients or people are using them, what the results are. So it's really buyer beware, but a lot of digital technologies, since it is a new field, haven't really proven themselves to the point of, you know, that kind of accuracy. There are very few. The most important thing is that the FDA and other regulatory bodies are addressing these technologies as well as artificial intelligence. I mean, there are now laws going in regulating what types of artificial intelligence need to be regulated, you know, how machine learning is regulated differently than other types of artificial intelligence, for example. So things are out, the genie is out of the bottle, and we have to deal with that. And so there's a lot of catching up to do. Technology develops a lot faster than healthcare policy with laws. It develops a lot faster than workflows in healthcare. So in other words, you can have the technology out there, but you can't get it into the electronic record, for example, unless you do certain things. So people have to be aware of the complexities of what digital health is involved with.
Absolutely. I think that your point about policy and its development parallel to the development of these technologies is so important to consider, and something that isn't talked about enough, especially because with artificial intelligence not fully understanding how it works, it becomes so easy to kind of look at it as a perfect solution that holds all the answers when it's really not, and it can even be more biased and more flawed than physicians themselves. So that was a great point. And to the point of technology developing, I guess for our final question, what is the importance of educating doctors on technology? And maybe can you tell us your thoughts with your experience about retraining doctors to keep up with new medical procedures that rely on cutting edge technology?
So that's a big question, but an important one. I don't think that every physician needs to know everything about digital health. There are physicians who are more interested than others. Physicians in general have been soured on digital health because of the electronic record and how cumbersome it is and how counterintuitive it is. And hopefully that'll change in time, but that's a big issue. And I'm actually on a committee called the Physician Burden Reduction Task Force of the Health Information Management System Society. And we're hopefully going to make recommendations that will decrease the amount of work that the electronic record makes people do unnecessarily. As technologies prove themselves and become absorbed into practice, as long as they're solving a problem for clinicians, I think they'll get, you know, embraced well. I think technology for technology's sake or building something and they will come are really not, you know, productive in any fashion except to make money for the companies. So companies that are developing these things need to know that they have to be answering a very significant problem in order to be successful.
Right, absolutely. This conversation has just been great because we've been learning a lot about digital health already. And I always try to keep up with the news, but having the kind of unique perspective that you have as a physician who has seen the dawn of digital health and the revolution in medical technology, and now with your experience as consulting and previously as a doctor, is so great, so that we are able to better understand what the digital health revolution really means for doctors and patients alike. So thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. It was really great to speak with you, and I'm sure listeners enjoyed as well.
My pleasure. And I'm glad that, you know, you're doing this, because it's really, I think, a fabulous thing. And digital health is something that you guys have been born into. So it's really not revolutionary from a logic standpoint. But you as a generation are going to see things develop even faster and greater, I think, than what we've seen. So I think you're in a good place, and I think it's a great time to be in technology.
Absolutely, and especially because of just how prevalent technology is around us for our generation, it's so important to focus on how it can really empower people and do work for the good. So yeah. Thank you so much once again for joining us. It was lovely talking with you.
My pleasure. Take care.